Thank you, David. I have a question for us to consider. Why do we do what we do? What is the foundation for it? Now, I'm not talking about those things that may be involuntary, like putting, you know, a spoon into our mashed potatoes and gravy and bringing it to our mouth, or breathing in and out, or those kinds of things. I'm talking about the things that we do more or less voluntarily, in the sense that not going to work or that kind of thing, but those things that we make a conscious choice to do. Things that pertain to our interactions with other people. Things that pertain to what we do with our free time. Things that pertain to the things that define our life in a probably spiritual sense. I promise you, I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not going to quote John Doe on the actions of why the actions of people or something like that. I'm not going to bring psychological things into it, except for, and this is a little bit like when you buy that unsweetened jam. I mean, fruit has some sweetness itself, so it will have some sweetness to it. But nothing was added, and that's what I'm saying here. The Bible does have psychology involved in it in that sense. It's just normal and natural. But I'm not going to add to that. Generally speaking, we do what we believe. In other words, we do those things that we are convicted of, that our convictions tell us to do, generally speaking. Sometimes out of weakness or fear or other factors, sometimes we may not do exactly what we're convicted of because for those reasons at times. But I'd like to illustrate this a little bit with a story. This story, it's based on a real incident. As they say, the names have been changed and so forth, but it is based on a real incident. Otto Wenn was a medical student and an intern. He was doing an internship at a hospital in New York City. Philip Fuller was one of his patients in room 260. He had come in on Sunday, the previous Sunday, with symptoms, with symptoms of a stroke, and they were doing testing and so forth, and observation on Philip Fuller to see what was wrong or what was going on with him and so forth. And he had been there since Sunday. So they were watching him and keeping track of him. And hopefully by Monday or maybe at the latest Tuesday, he'd get the test results, and then unless there was some mitigating circumstance created or shown by the testing, he was going to go home. And he was anxious to get home. But Monday came and no test results. So, well, okay, Tuesday, it probably will come Tuesday. So Tuesday came. Still no test results. Nothing had happened. And he kept asking Otto what the problem was. What's the holdup? Why are these tests not showing up? Well, they didn't come Wednesday. And Thursday morning they hadn't come. So when Otto walked into the room, Otto Wenn, Philip Fuller had ripped off all his electrical connections or whatever they put on you for monitoring you. He had taken out his IV because they'd given him an IV to keep him hydrated and also to keep nourishment up for him and keep his strength up. He had ripped all those off. He had put on his clothes and he was packing his bags. And Otto said, "What are you doing?" when he came in. He said, "I'm leaving. I'm going home." We said, "Why are you doing that?" because I cannot trust this hospital. You were supposed to give me the tests on Monday or possibly Tuesday. Didn't come on Wednesday, and now it's Thursday, and I'm still here. What's going on? I'm leaving. I'm getting out of here because I don't trust this hospital anymore. I can't stay here. I'm leaving. Otto panicked. He ran out into the... This wouldn't, for one thing, look good on his internship record if somebody walked out on him, for one thing. But more than that, Philip could be in danger. His life could be in jeopardy. Serious consequences could take place if he left and he wasn't monitored and they hadn't got the results back and hadn't read them. He ran out into the hallway, and just as he did, a senior doctor was coming down the hallway. He stopped him, and the doctor said, "What's going on? What's the matter?" He said, "Well, this patient in room 260 is taking himself out of the hospital. He's leaving. He's going home." And he explained what was going on with him in a medical sense. And the doctor said, "Well, I will talk to him. I'll go in and I'll talk to him." So he went in to the room and he said, "Hi, Phil. I'm O.S. Trams. I'm a doctor here at the hospital, and I was just informed of your condition by Otto Wen here, the intern." He calmly offered him a glass of water, and he asked him, could we sit down for a couple of minutes and chat?" To which Philip agreed. So they sat down, and he said, "Phil," he looked at his chart, he said, I understand why you are so upset. I understand that you were expecting these results and they haven't come." He said, "In fact, I believe you're owed an explanation. So I'm going to call the lab and I'm going to check at the lab to see what's going on, why these tests have not come, why you've had to wait all this time." And then he asked a key question. He said, "What is it, Phil, or what is it that makes you feel it's so important to leave?" Now, he had told Otto that "I don't trust the hospital." But very rarely, when something is wrong, very rarely will a person give you the real reason of what's going on. It very rarely happens. When you're making a big decision hastily and so forth in the heat of the moment, you very rarely hear what's really going on. But he got, because of his non-threatening and his inquisitive tone of voice, he got the real reason. Philip Fuller told him the real reason. He said that he had promised the widow next door that he would put a ramp in for her so that her mother, who was coming for Sunday dinner this coming Sunday, so that she could get in the house. And he was not fulfilling his obligation. He had promised her, and it was now Thursday, and it still hadn't been done. He had promised that he would do that for her. "Well," Dr. Tram said, he said, "you know what?" He said, "I might have a solution." He said, "I have a man that's putting a deck on my house, in the back of my house. And there's no timetable on it." He said, "I can easily just have him go over to this lady and to put in a ramp for her. And he can have it done at least in a day, probably, or maybe a day and a half. And it'll be ready for your mother-in-law, or for your mother, rather, on Sunday." Problem solved, situation diffused, the patient stayed because he had taken the time to listen to him and he had taken the time to provide a solution. We recently talked about neutralizing fear with faith. To neutralize is to render something ineffective or harmless by applying an opposite force or effect. And that's exactly what happened here. Philip Fuller had a belief system that when he made a promise to somebody, that he had to keep it. He was going to keep it. Now, belief and faith are pretty much synonymous. Belief in the English dictionaries will tell you the same thing. That's confidence, conviction, trust. Belief is that, and so is faith. Both of them are very much synonymous. And Philip had given his word, he had given his bond that he was going to do this, and his conviction said, his belief said, his faith said that he had to do that for the neighbor and to get that done. He had promised, and he was willing to step out in faith into the unknown to do this for the neighbor lady, the widow neighbor lady. He was willing to take that risk that could endanger his life because he had made a promise and he was convicted that he needed to keep that promise. Now, faith, as the Bible indicates, is a talent given to us by God. And it is. But it's not a full-blown talent. It's not a full-grown, fully developed talent. In Matthew, the 25th chapter, and we won't go there, but we'll just refer to it. You can read it sometime if you haven't, but you probably have. It's a pretty familiar section of Scripture. Matthew, the 25th chapter, it talks about the 10 virgins, and then it talks about the traveler who had gone away and had given 5 talents to one person, 2 talents to another, and 1 talent to a third person, and how they were supposed to multiply or increase those talents. Well, faith is one of those talents that we're tasked with and expected to develop. We're expected to strengthen it. It's expected that it will grow as we go. But how can we strengthen and develop our faith? What's the way to do that? How can we do that? In Hebrews, the 10th chapter, and we will start there, Hebrews 10, in verse 38, it says, "The just shall live by faith." And that's taken from Habakkuk, or, you know, Deuteronomy and Leviticus, we pronounce that all the time, but Habakkuk we don't pronounce all that often, so it may be a little more vague as to the exact correct pronunciation. I recently heard a fellow had asked, was talking to a Hebrew-speaking person of faith, and he was talking about Nehemiah, and the person said, "Nehemiah, is that in the Bible? What's that?" And he showed him where it was. He said, "Oh, you mean Nehemiah," which may be the Hebrew way of pronouncing it, and that's a little bit like Habakkuk. We won't go there, but that's where this comes from. The just shall live by faith. When we think about faith, we're right here. We usually think of one of the first things we think of is Hebrews, the 11th chapter. So we'll just stay right here, and we'll get right on down to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. The just, and verse 38, "Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition or destruction, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul." We are of those who believe, or those who have faith. Chapter 11, verse 1. "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." Now, those words are a little religious sounding, but what they mean, faith is the foundation of things hoped for. It is the confidence or the conviction. It is the conviction of things not seen. It's the faith is the confidence of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. We're convicted of things that we don't exactly know about. We have evidence, but we're not, since we've never done it, we believe that the sun is going to come up tomorrow morning because it always has. But since it hasn't come up, we sort of take it on faith or belief. That's what we believe. We haven't seen it come up yet tomorrow morning, but it will. Verse 2, for by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. We were talking a week or so ago about that things break down into particles so small and so tiny that eventually, as matter gets broken down, it does become invisible. God created it, and then he used those invisible parts and put together and created the earth, created the world, the things that we do see. Here in this chapter, there are quite a number of people that are listed as being faithful, people of faith. Abel, for example, he was basically the first faithful person when he offered an offering to God that God accepted. And Enoch, going on down through Noah, was a faithful person. Abraham was a faithful person, as were Isaac and Jacob, and Abraham's wife, Sarah, Isaac's mother, and so on. As we read down through here, we read accounts and little snippets of their life of a number of people, Joseph, Moses, and Rahab. And we come down to, all the way down to verse 32. It said, and what more shall I say? The writer of Hebrews, who is believed to be Paul, but there was no author given, so it has to be style of writing and what he's talking about and so on is taken into account to determine that it probably was Paul. He said, what more shall I say? What else is there to say? The time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and also of David and Samuel and the prophets. Well, these people, some of them at least, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, and even Gideon, are not the first people who would come to my mind when I'm thinking of faith. So I thought we could take a case study, and we're going to look at the life of Gideon, or the, not the whole life, but a particular section of Gideon's life, a case study, if you will, and look at it and see what we can learn about faith and Gideon and strengthening our faith, keeping it growing, so to speak. In Judges, the sixth chapter, 6-8, is where most of the information is about Gideon, at least in this particular setting, the information that we want to look at. In the sixth chapter of Judges, we'll look at verse 1. And then the children, it says, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Now, we're going to get a little bit of background on this. When the children of Israel came out of Egypt, we know about the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, and then they finally were able to get into the promised land, the land of Canaan. And they fought the skirmishes and little wars and bigger wars that they had with the inhabitants of the land till they finally had them cleaned out enough to where they could cast lots for, and they could allocate to every tribe their portion of land. Of course, 2.5 of them stayed on the east side of the Jordan instead of on the west side, the Mediterranean side of it, and Manasseh and two others stayed over there and took their portion on the east side of the Jordan. But the rest of them got their land in the land of Canaan. They were doing well, quite well, as long as Joshua was alive. Now, Joshua, as you probably remember, was the fellow that the person that was leading the charge after Moses, and when they came into the promised land, because Moses couldn't get in, wasn't allowed to go into the promised land, then Joshua took over. And by the way, Joshua is the same name as Jesus, but it's in the Hebrew. Jesus is the Greek name, Greek word for Joshua. But anyway, be that as it may, in Judges 2, turning back just a couple of chapters, when Joshua had dismissed the people, this was after the wars were over and everything had settled down, he dismissed the people, and the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. It says in verse 7, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. So for quite a period of time, because Joshua died when he was 110 years old, for quite a period of time, there was peace, and there was they settled down and so forth, and they served the Lord. But in verse 10, it says another generation arose after them that did not know the Lord or the work which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Now, this is something that happened over and over and over again through the entire life of Israel in the history of the Bible. They would have a period of peace, and they would serve God, and then for one reason or another, they started into idolatry, and they started falling away from God, and so on and so forth. And that's what happened here. And it says, verse 13, they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtoreths, which the nations around them, and that's who it was that they were following, those nations that lived in the land of Canaan. Just as they had Egypt, when they came out of Egypt, they were steeped in the ways of the Egyptians. Here, they started serving the gods of the Canaanites, the Baals and the Ashtoreths, who did hideous things, a lot of sexual misconduct, all the way down to even sacrificing their children on altars of fire. And God hates those things because they lead away from his way and his plan. Says, though, that even though they did this and then they suffered for it, in verse 16, nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And that's what Gideon was. He was one of the judges. In fact, he was the one that came after a lady, Deborah, who was a judge also. And he was the next one after that. When Deborah had taken care of the Canaanites in chapter 4, mostly, 4, 2 through 4, and then also at the completely at the end of chapter 5, the last verse there, it says all the enemies were taken care of. It said, so then, and this was through Deborah's reign, the land had rest for 40 years. Deborah was righteous, and they lived in peace as long as they were serving God. That's where we get the verse, or chapter 6, and in verse 1, where they did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and for 7 years, the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Midianites. Now, Midian was one of the sons of Abraham also, so he was a very distant relative to these people. He was from a wife that he married after Sarah. When she died, he married Keturah, and Midian was one of four sons that he had. So they were harassing him. The Midianites and some of the other peoples from the east, it says. And for 7 years, they were causing issues. And it says here that the Midianites came up to the land. They were like Bedouins. They were nomads. They wandered around they were from the east of the Jordan, but they wandered around in the desert and so forth. It says that they had come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. I don't know if you've ever seen a swarm of locusts, but in the fall, something that might be similar. It's not as there may be not as many as there were way on early on in when people, the white Europeans, first came to this country. There were flocks of birds that were so thick that you couldn't see the sky. It blocked out the sun. But in the fall, when the birds congregate to migrate, it would probably be a little bit like that. It said they came in like swarms of locusts. Both they and their camels were without number. They were camel jockeys. They were they rode on camels, and camels were a very good method of transportation in that particular type of environment because they had broad, wide hoofs. They were up to 9 feet tall. They could travel fast over inhospitable territory, and they're famous and well known for the fact that they can go for days without water because they have some type of pouches in their stomach where they drink a lot of water and it stays there, and they use it as needed, and somewhat food too. So camels were perfect for traveling around in that hot, sandy desert type environment. So that's what they used, and they were also pretty fast. But what happened? 7 years, they were being plagued by this. They were without number, innumerable, it says, and they would enter the land to destroy it. That was their purpose, to harass the Israelites, destroy it, take what they wanted and head out somewhere else. But it happened time after time after time. The Israelites would sin and they would go after other gods. Then they would cry out to the Lord. In verse 6, Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Well, God heard. God would hear them. First, he sent them a prophet. And this prophet, that the prophet's not named, but this prophet told them what the problem was, why they had so much trouble, why the Midianites were coming in, overpowering them, and why this was happening to them. He gave them the reason why, and he said, it's because you have turned away from God, and you're no longer serving God, you're serving the Baals. But he didn't offer us a solution other than to turn and serve the Lord. Then in verse 11, starting in verse 11, Gideon comes into the picture. He had an encounter with God. And Gideon was a man probably in a lot of ways like we are. He got scared. He was afraid when he was threatened, and obviously, he got hot when he was hot out, and he had the similar feelings and similar thoughts that we were. He did not like discomfort. He did not like the fact that the Midianites were oppressing them. It said, now the angel of the Lord came in verse 11 and sat under the oak tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon. And Gideon, by the way, his name is sort of funny. The definition of his name is sort of funny. It means tree feller. Not like, hey, this feller is coming for dinner, but like a tree, somebody that cuts down trees. And it indicates warrior is what it means, what the basis for that is. But Gideon was thrashing his wheat in the wine press. Now, why was he doing that? The wine press is a cistern hewn out of rock below the ground. Normally, when you're thrashing wheat, or when they did it at that point, they'd be thrashing it on a flat rock up high somewhere so the wind would carry off the chaff. They'd throw the kernels of wheat in the air. The chaff would blow away, and the wheat kernels would fall back on the rock. And that's how they did the thrashing. Thrashing is hot, dusty, dirty work, and I can tell you that from experience. We used to do that, and it's usually in the hottest time of year, July, from the beginning of July, well, probably more like the middle of July to early August is when most of the thrashing gets done. And that's just when summer is at its hottest. And so that's probably what he was doing. But he was down in this wine press doing it. And why was he doing it down there? In order to hide it from the Midianites, because they would come, they would take everything they had. If they caught him threshing, he would be lucky to leave with his life, and not, he wouldn't leave with any of his grain, because they would take it all. But now his encounter starts with God. He said this angel had come and sat under the oak tree, and the first thing he says is sort of a curious statement. The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. Now, as you read on through here, you wonder, why did he call him you mighty man of valor? I would think it would be an anticipation of what he was going to do and not for what he had done. Because it seems like Gideon was a little shy and timid and fearful, and he did not have a lot of faith, that he was lacking in faith. Although he knew about God, though. Gideon said to him, and this we bandy this about a lot ourselves. Gideon said, "Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? Where are all his miracles? Why, we heard about all the things he did when we were coming out of Egypt. What happened to all that? Where are they now, those miracles? What's going on? Why don't we see him now? If God is with us, then why is all this happening to us?" But now he said, "The Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites," their distant relatives. It's the same thing that we bandy about today a lot. Why are there no miracles? Well, there are, but we just don't see miracles of the kind he was talking about. I've never gone to the higher river and it parted and I could walk across. I always had to take the bridge. And I'm sure that is the case for most of us. We've never had those kind of miracles. Manna has never fallen out of heaven and I've been able to eat without working and paying for the food I ate. That's never happened. And this is what Gideon was referring to. But the Lord said, now we find out that this angel was none other than the Lord himself, which must have been Jesus Christ, because nobody, just like Moses, nobody has ever seen God and lived. Said, but the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours," and here he does it again. It's a form of encouragement to Gideon. It's a form of building him up, a form of letting him know that God believed him in him, even if he didn't believe himself. "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites, because I have sent you." But Gideon was not buying it. He wasn't ready to jump out and up and down and do somersaults and hand claps, because he had small faith. He was not a person with powerful faith at this time. Here's what he said. "My Lord, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh." He was a Manassite. "And I am the weakest or the least in my father's house." So he was the weakest, he thought, of the weak. "And how am I going to be able to do this?" Well, the Lord told him, "I'll be with you. I will be with you." These are small things that he was giving to Gideon to build his faith. He was starting to build his faith up. So he gave him a mission, a smaller mission, a preliminary mission, something that he could do, that he could see accomplishment in. He gave him a mission in verse 25. This was after the Lord. Well, first of all, let's just rehearse this one little thing. Gideon, and this is usually a sign of weak faith, Gideon asked for a sign. So the angel from the angel, so that he would know for sure that this angel was actually from the Lord. He said, I'm going to go get some food for you. And so he went, killed a goat, cooked the meat, made some unleavened bread, and had some broth. And he brought the broth in a pot and the meat in a basket. Came back, because the angel had promised he'd stay there. And the sign he showed him, he said, put the meat on the rock here and the unleavened bread. Pour out the broth. So he did. The angel took his staff, touched the meat, and like a little bit like Elijah when he asked for fire to come from heaven, the rock burst into flames, consumed the meat and the unleavened bread, and I'm sure that Gideon was impressed. It was an impressive act, but now he had another problem. He was afraid that because he had seen God, that God would kill him. But God, in his mercy, did not do that. Now, in verse 25, here is the mission. You are to take your father, the bull, one of your bulls from your father's flock, herd, and you are to take it, and you are to tear down the altars of Baal, your father's altars of Baal. And these were very important to these people by this time. They shouldn't have been, but they were. They'd been for 7 years, they'd been building altars and worshiping Baal and making sacrifices to Baal and so forth. And he said, tear those down, build an altar in their place, use the wood from the shrines that they had made to Baal, take those, make a fire, and put this bull on the fire and sacrifice it. So they did, but he was still fearful, which he probably should have been, and he did it at night so that he wouldn't be caught. The next morning, all the people said, what happened here? Who did this dreadful deed? Tore these things down. And he had taken 10 men with him to do this job, to accomplish this, Gideon had. So one of them must have been ratted him out and told the neighbors that it was Gideon. And so they, of course, they wanted to kill him. The idea was, we're going to kill him for this. But Gideon's dad, to his credit, stood up and he said, look, if these are gods, they can speak for themselves. Why kill Gideon? They can speak for themselves. Just let them speak for themselves, make their own defense, and if they want to kill Gideon, they can. Well, of course, we know the outcome of that story. Nothing happened. And Gideon survived that. So here was a little mission that the Lord had given Gideon that turned out okay, that was positive. It was a small faith builder for Gideon. He had a little bit of success, and his faith could grow because of that. But Gideon had a much bigger mission to come. The angel of the Lord gave him a lot bigger mission, which he had already articulated when he first came, that you're going to save Israel from the Midianites. So that was the next. In verse 33 of chapter 6, all the Midianites and the Amalekites, people of the east, gathered themselves together, and they crossed over and they encamped in the valley of Jezreel. Jezreel is up in the northern part of West Manasseh. If you could look in the back of your Bible, if you have a map in there that shows the allotment of the 12 tribes, you'll see that western Manasseh has a little, sort of a little spur that sticks up into Issachar, and that's where the Jezreel Valley was, right there on the border between Issachar and West Manasseh. And they had come over, all the Amalekites, or not the, the Midianites and the Amalekites had come over to camp in that area in a valley. So the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon. He blew the trumpet, and sure enough, he was able to gather some of the people of his tribe, the Manasseh of Manasseh, together. And he also sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they also came, and they all gathered together there. But still, Gideon did not quite have the faith, the confidence, the belief that this was really going to be, he was really going to be able to do. So we know the famous story of the fleece that Gideon had. He had a fleece, sheep skin, and sheepskins are very good. We used to take, we had sheep, and so we butchered a couple, and we had, took a sheepskin, and they worked very well for keeping you warm when you were sitting on a cast iron seat on a plow or some other implement, because when it was cold, those things transferred a lot of cold to your body. But when you put a sheepskin or a fleece on there, it took care of that. You didn't have that problem. It kept you warm. And the other nice thing about it, normally we turn them over, but if we forgot, fleece does not absorb water. You could shake the water out, and it would pretty much, and wring it out a little bit, it would pretty much be dry, even though you had forgot to turn it around, and even though it rained on it. So that's what they had. He had a piece of fleece of wool, and he put it, he said, God, just show me one more sign, one more sign. I'll put this fleece out here. If the fleece is wet tomorrow morning, and everything around it is dry, I will know that you are with me and that you are going to do this. Well, the next morning he stood up, and guess what? The fleece was wet and the ground around it was dry. But like we do sometimes, maybe that was just a coincidence. Am I sure that that was really God's hand working? Maybe not. Maybe, you know what, I better have another little sign. So like Abraham, when the messengers came to tell him about his nephew Lot, he said, just one more thing. Just once more. Give me just one additional sign to make sure that I know what I'm doing and that it's really you telling me this and that this is really going to happen. I'm going to put the fleece out there. Tomorrow morning, if it's wet all around it, and the fleece is dry, then I will know that that's what's going, that you're telling me the truth. So he did. And, you know, I don't know that it's a recommended thing for us to do this kind of thing, but it worked. The fleece was dry and the ground around it was wet, so he was pretty much satisfied that what was happening, or what God had told him was going to happen, actually did happen. And He finally got another lesson in faith, starting in chapter 7. This was a pretty strong lesson. The Amalekites numbered 135,000 people. 135,000. The people that Gideon was able to draft and muster up for his army, 32,000. How is God, Gideon's thinking, how is God going to take care of these 135,000 Amalekites, Midianites, with 32,000? Well, God came back to him and he said, you know what, Gideon? These are too many. Your army is too big. We're going to have to pare them down. So he said, have everyone, ask them all, anyone who is fearful or afraid, get him out of here. Let him go home. So 22,000 turned tail and ran. went back home. Now he was down to 10,000. 10,000 men against 135,000 warriors. Not good. Not the kind of odds that any of us would like. We certainly wouldn't go to Vegas with those odds, that's for sure. But God said, it's still too many. You still have too many people. 10,000 people are too much for you to go to war with. So guess what happened? Said, I got another little test for you. He said, go down to the water and do this little test. Everybody that gets down on their knees and drinks out of the water that way, have them go to one side. And then everybody else that stands there, grabs water and brings it up to their face and drinks it that way, have them step to another area. Keep them separated. So he did that. 300 of them drank water out of their hands. 9,700 of them drank down from off their knees. Those he sent home. Now we got 300 people left. And he must have been wondering, how in the world are we going to do this? Well, God had a plan. He knew what he was doing. He sent him down and he said, go down to the camp of the Amalekites if you still need some more encouragement, which he did. Went down to the camp of the Amalekites and he snuck in, and he and his servant saw or heard these two Midianites, rather. They might have been Amalekites because they were both there. He saw overheard these two Midianites talking, and the one said, I had a dream. A roll of barley rolled off the hill, a loaf of barley bread actually, rolled off the hill down into the tent and destroyed the tent. I don't know if it blew up or what happened, but it destroyed the tent. And the other guy said, this is nothing but the sword of Gideon. That's what it is. And Gideon went back encouraged. He was ready to fight. So they took pitchers, put a torch under it, and in their left hand, in their right hand, they took trumpets to blow. They circled the camp. They were in three, they separated in three 100 person groups. They circled the camp, and then all together, they smashed the pitchers so the torches could be seen, and with the other hand, they blew the trumpets. Well, the Amalekites and the Midianites thought that they were surrounded by great armies, and they turned on each other, and they killed a lot of people that day. They killed 120,000 people just among themselves. 15,000 fled, and Gideon and his men, and then he called some of the Ephraimites and a few other tribes, and they pursued him, and the bottom line was they ended up killing every one of them. In chapter 8 and in verse 28, the final result is mentioned. It says, the Midianites were subdued before the children of Israel so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. So Gideon accomplished, or God through Gideon accomplished what Gideon knew that he couldn't do himself. And the indications are that as Gideon went along, he got stronger and stronger. Now, how does Gideon's story help us, though, to strengthen our faith to live by? The title of my message is Faith to Live By, but how is that going to help us? When we first encountered Gideon, he was not very, very faithful. He had very little faith. He didn't have much belief. He was timid. I am weak. Not only am I weak, my clan is weak, and I'm the weakest of my clan, of my father's house, who is part of this clan. How am I supposed to be able to do anything and to take care of the Midianites? But as the saying goes, God does not call the prepared. He prepares the called. When we first came into this way of believing, we were probably like Gideon when he started out. We weren't that prepared. We weren't that, didn't have that much faith. But as we went along, our faith grew. Like Gideon, God encouraged us. He kept telling Gideon, "You mighty man of valor," and encouraged him by saying, "Take your might and do this and do that." God does that to us as well. We have people here in the church that are great encouragers. We might talk to somebody every week or any week and be encouraged just because we talk to them. There was a lady that I used to love to talk to, and she, years ago in the church, because I always felt stronger and more encouraged when I left services and church because of that lady, because she talked to you and there was just something about it. She had the gift to encourage people. But things happen to us that encourages us, just like they did to Gideon. Things happen that strengthen us, that strengthen our faith, strengthen our beliefs. Miracles, the unleavened bread on the rock, the fleece, those miracles that he saw strengthened his faith. And I know that every one of us could look back in our life and we could cite a miracle, whether it was our calling, whether it was some other thing that happened to us. Every one of us has some things that we could look at and say, you know, that was a miracle. That was a miracle in my life. I'll tell you one of mine. In July of 2013, I was coming through Baltimore, Maryland, and I was coming home. It was either a Thursday or a Friday, and it was around noon, day like today, a nice sunny day. And I got on Interstate 70, I got to Hagerstown, Maryland, and I was right smack dab over Interstate 81 that goes north and south. Interstate 70, as it does through here, south in Columbus, goes east and west. And I got there, and all of a sudden, without warning, there were no taillights, no anything to say this or to alert me to it. Traffic was at a dead stop. Everything was at a dead stop. And I almost hit the vehicle in front of me. But I got stopped in time, and just as I stopped, somebody else behind me, an SUV with pulling two motorcycles on a trailer behind it, pulled up behind me. Another vehicle had right lane. Another vehicle had pulled up just about the front fender. A small black car had pulled up to the front fender of my car. At that moment, I looked in my mirror. There was a semi coming full blast that had not seen that traffic was stopped, and he was right behind us. Well, he hit the car behind me and totaled it. But just as he was ready to hit it, and I don't know how this possibly could have happened without him upsetting his trailer, he did a little S maneuver, got into the next lane. And I had already lowered myself and was bracing for impact because I just knew he was going to hit me, and he was going to hit the person behind me. And I thought, this could be it. He went flying by me. Debris and dust was flying everywhere. He hit the fellow in the little car in front of me, spun him around a couple of times, flipped him over, and he landed right in front of me with his on all four tires. Blew out all his windows. He demolished two other cars in the same lane. He got over and he crushed an SUV up against the rail, the side rail of the bridge. Took him 45 minutes to get people out of there, out of that SUV. I thought the guy for sure in front of me was dead because nothing happened. For probably at least two full minutes, nothing happened. He was just laying there. And then he must have been knocked out, because then he got up and stretched a little bit, and he climbed out through the window, got over to the rail and sat down on the curb. Behind me, the girl in the SUV behind me got out of the SUV and she ran to the rail and she started vomiting violently over the rail. So I went back and I asked her how bad she was hurt. She says, "I'm not hurt," but she said, "2 days ago, I totaled my car." And we're heading to a funeral in Michigan, and she said it just made me violently ill, the whole episode. Dust and debris flew everywhere, and I still can remember the noise of that semi going by me. But you know what? Not even a piece of debris hit my car. There was not a dent, not a scratch, nothing. And I was the only one right in the middle of a five-car collision. All five of those cars around me were totaled, and I was not even hit. Another lady who had come up behind me told me, she said, "I saw the whole thing, and it's a miracle. You just lived through a miracle." And I believe I did. It took about 2 hours, but they took out the vehicles behind us, and we backed up about a quarter of a mile and got around it, and I was able to get on home. And she, a couple days later, she'd gotten my email address, and she sent me pictures of everything because she took pictures. I don't know how badly the people in front of me were hurt. They were hurt, but I don't know how badly. I don't believe anybody was killed. But it was a miracle. And I'm sure that you, when you go back in your life, I'm sure you can do the same thing. You can find miracles in your life that have strengthened your faith. I know that did mine. Small victories. The altars of Baal, that was the first thing that Gideon did. It was a small victory, but it was a victory. And it increased his faith. The same thing happens to us when we have small victories. Maybe we finally decided that we're going to be strong enough. We're going to say, "I can't work on Friday nights after sundown anymore, and I won't do it." You did it, nothing happened, or at least nothing bad. Or another small victory might have impacted you. But they led to bigger victories for Gideon. The defeating of the Midianites and peace for 40 years that they experienced. Maybe you've had the same thing. Maybe you've finally decided that this year, I know it could jeopardize my job. I know that maybe it'll negatively impact me, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to the feast. And you did. Nothing bad happened. All these things can make our faith and do make our faith stronger. As the writer of Hebrews said, the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by faith. It's like blind Mr. Magoo. We walk out on that beam, and sure enough, just as we step out, even though we can't see it, another beam comes up and we walk across it. That kind of thing. Faith is the foundation of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Hebrews 11, 1. What we really have faith in, what we believe strongly enough, is generally what we will do. We generally will follow our convictions, like Gideon did, like Philip Fuller did. Actions generally follow faith. As James said, "You show me your faith without works, and I'll show you my faith by my works." What I will do, I will show you by my works. For our final scripture, let's go back to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Hebrews 11, and we'll start where we left off in verse 32. Again he said, "What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions. They quench the violence of fire. They escape the edge of the sword, and out of weakness were made strong. That's what we can become. That's how, if we keep strengthening our faith consistently and constantly, that's what will happen to us. Out of weakness, we will be made strong. As our faith grows, we will be able to do things that we never imagined that we can do. As our faith becomes stronger and stronger, as we increase that talent of faith that God has given us. Thank you.